Sunday, January 7th, 2007. Time for the first industry misinterpretations of the year. Michael Lucas Smith couldn't join us today because we arranged for 9:15 a.m. Eastern Time today, and he suddenly realized how late that was in Australia. As it happens, I wasn't sure that my schedule would permit to have something recorded later in the day, so we just went forward at 9:15, David Buck and I. Things that are in CINCOM Smalltalk that you may not remember or even realize are there. There were plenty of things that, over time, I either wasn't aware of, hadn't been aware of, or only even recently became aware of, and I'm sure other people will have the same experience. It's a good podcast. Hope you enjoy it. And remember, we take feedback at smalltalkpodcasts@cincom.com. Also, if you head on over to the iTunes page in the iTunes Music Store, you can leave comments, feedback, and reviews there. As well, we have a Podcast Alley page. We'd be more than happy to take votes or feedback there. Thanks.
Hey, darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you. I gotta be interesting.
Go ahead. You had a fairly long list of little-known things in visual works, and I'm actually interested in the first thing you started with, this context.
Yeah, a little secret, actually. As small talkers, we're used to saying that there are five reserved words. Those are self, super, nil, true, and false. It turns out in visual works, there's a little-known sixth reserved word called this context, which is a rather interesting little word. It means... give me an object corresponding to the top of the call stack frame. With this object, I can look at local variables in the call stack. I can look at who sent this message. I can look at all the previous frames in the call stack. So there are lots of really neat things I can do with this context.
Yeah, this is another one of those things, interestingly enough, that I find that people who first learn about it get kind of the same excitement they do when they learn that they can concatenate two strings, turn them into a symbol, and send arbitrary messages. they decide that there are all sorts of cool things they can do, and then, I don't know, 2-3 months later, they go, holy smokes, there's all sorts of things I should never do in any real system.
Yes.
Because I remember doing, oh gosh, this is years ago, I think it was before I was a sales engineer even, I might have been a trainer consultant at the time, but I had somebody ask me if there was any real way to check arguments coming into a method, and I showed them a way of doing it with this context where you just grab, you know, create what amounts to a before method. I mean, not really a before method. You can actually do that with bytecode injection, which is yet another technique that actually isn't on your list exactly, but it's another really kind of naughty little technique that some people do.
I remember once I was giving a course, and one person on the course was very interested in making his code bulletproof, even to outside developers within the same environment. So he was asking if he could check to see if the caller of this method is one of the approved callers, basically to make a method private. So I mentioned this context and how we could use it, and he was all excited by this. He was going in and making all of his methods private and using this context. And then every time he did that, I found some sort of way of bypassing it and accessing his variables directly or calling his methods directly, and he was getting all upset. So it's not something that gives you security. It's a little thing in the environment that helps you do some things that are important. Like this context is really essential for continuations in the C-side style.
Well, I've also found it useful, to be honest, in debug reports with my... You know, for instance, in the blog server that I host, I will often use this context simply when something has gone wrong that I'd like to report more information on. I'll just grab this context in order to do a full stack dump, you know, because it's an interesting way of being able to do it whether you're in, you'll get a stack dump out of the stuff that either a headless server has or the stuff that Runtime Packager creates as the default exception handler. But I'm running actually just a development image that I've saved on the server, and you can just grab this context anytime you get an exception and dump out an arbitrary stack report so that you don't have to debug the headless server live. You can actually take a look at it offline.
Yeah, it's very handy. It's, again, one of those things you don't want to use very much throughout your code, but when you do need it, it comes in very handy.
Yeah, and as far as I know, the only other Smalltalk that has it under this name is, and this is not a big surprise given that they have common roots, is Squeak. And I don't even know whether the other small talks have something similar. I would expect that Smalltalk X probably does, but I'm not familiar enough with some of the others.
I'm not familiar with Smalltalk X in that way. This context is certainly not understood by Visual Age. They may have something similar. They do have something similar for getting stacks, but not with a reserved word. So there is a mechanism for getting a stack trace, but it doesn't use, at this context, reserved word.
Okay.
So the next thing I had on my list is one that everybody uses, but quite often people don't really understand what it does, and that's the word super. Interestingly, when I was giving a course for the object people, in the course we had a slide on how super works. And one time I was trying to go through the course with another instructor who was going to be giving it, and we came up to the slide, and I said, okay, here's this example. Now tell me what this prints out. And he gave me the wrong answer, and he'd been using Smalltalk for years and years. It's really rather confusing. Super means, and I'm going to say it as precisely as I can, it's send a message to the same object as self, but start the method lookup in the class above the one where the current method is defined.
Yeah.
So that's the precise definition of it. And if you really want to work out what method is being looked up, you really have to follow that definition. If you're in a subclass, let's say you have class A, class B, class C, B is a subclass of A, C is a subclass of B. If there's a method in B that says super, and you send a message to an instance of C, if you hit that inherited method and it calls super, no matter whether B defines that method or not, you're always going to look in A for that method.
Right.
And that's what confuses people. They'll think, well, it's the super class of the receiver, which is not the case. If the receiver is a C, but the method was found in class B, then the super class it starts looking at is the super class of B, not C. So
yeah.
I've seen a lot of people get confused by that.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I think I've internalized that a long time ago, but now that you're mentioning this in a class context, I remember going through this exact thing multiple times in the Intro to VisualWorks class way, way back in the day when I was teaching those classes. And you're right, this was always kind of a mind-blowing thing for people. The only thing I can ever remember that used to bother people more, well, there were two things that used to bother people more depending on their level of expertise. And the intro class aspect adapters always baffled them. Mm-hmm. And that was because we introduced them on Wednesdays and they'd really only gotten through the syntax on Tuesday. So that kind of threw them for a loop.
An advanced topic to cover early in the course.
Yeah, typically what we used to say in the class was that Wednesday was when the back of people's heads opened up and their brains fell out.
That's right.
But the funny thing is, the thing that kind of always got your, not beginning Smalltalk people, but people who've been around Smalltalk enough that they started looking not just at super, but they started looking at the object hierarchy, and they noticed that it goes to behavior and then wraps, or goes
yes.
to object and then wraps, you know, through behavior. And I can remember multiple people who would insist on getting out a marker and a whiteboard and trying to sketch it on a whiteboard until they could make sense of it.
It goes. It's an amazing diagram. It goes four levels to the right if you wish to consider it like going from an instance to its class. It's going to the right. It goes out four levels to the right before it loops.
Yeah.
And then on the class side, it goes higher than on the instance side, and the class side loops back to the instance side.
I know, and that's where you always see people with the confusing diagram on the board, and there's always one or two of them in the room scratching their heads going, huh, what?
Well, the way I say it to courses I teach, I say that the concept of a class method versus an instance method is nothing in the language itself. It's the way the browser presents it to you.
Yeah.
So the browser is telling you this is a class method or this is an instance method, when really it's just a method on a class. It's arbitrarily chosen that subclasses of class, well, those are going to be classes, and therefore those are going to be called class methods.
Yeah, and that really blows people away when they come to that realization, because if you look at other languages, you know, Java doesn't really have class objects really at all in the sense of method lookup. And I don't remember C++ well enough. I don't.
C++ doesn't have first class classes. It has the virtual table.
There you go, yeah.
It really doesn't have the same concept at all. It's very similar to Java in that respect.
Yeah, so people coming in from Java or C++ and they see this, it always creates that sort of head-scratching moment where they're trying to look at the whiteboard and try to figure out why that works the way it works.
Interestingly, there is one Smalltalk I've seen that doesn't have that kind of structure for classes, and that is HashSmalltalk.
Oh, that's the one that was created by the Refactory guys, right?
Yes, Don Robertson. I hope his name's right. Don Robertson, John Brandt.
Yeah. Don Roberts, John Brandt, yes.
They're trying to interface to the classes in C# or in the .NET platform, and so they're trying to mimic that. And the .NET platform doesn't have that concept, so they didn't put it into their Smalltalk.
Yeah, well, does that mean that Vista Smalltalk also doesn't have that concept?
Vista Smalltalk isn't trying to map to .NET classes in quite the same way.
Okay.
It interfaces to the classes, but it doesn't try to do it in quite the same way as HashSmalltalk. Although I must say I haven't checked to see whether Vista classes have that full class meta class hierarchy.
Well, so if it does, that's a whole new generation of .NET programmers who can kind of get their mind bent by this same concept.
That's right. I was working on one contract once, and this gets on to the next point here. Somebody came up to me and said, "Here's some source code. What's this thing?" And what they were pointing at was a literal that said 2R and then 10110101. And I said, "That's binary." "Oh, I didn't know that was there."
Nobody knows that's there, actually. Hardly anybody knows that you can do this.
Yeah. If you want to create a binary literal, instead of having to punch in the decimal value, 53 or whatever it might be, you can put 2, meaning base 2, followed by a lowercase r, meaning radix, and then followed by the binary number. The interesting thing about that is that it works not only for binary, but also for hex. So you can put 16r and then followed by a hex decimal number with the digits 0 to 9 and the letters A to F.
Yeah.
And even people who know those two aren't aware that it also works for every other number.
For the times you really need base 15 or base 14.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, it even works for base 36.
Yeah, although the interesting thing is the most common place I see this is in C, DLLCC hookups to libraries. You'll see it for constants where a C programmer has defined a constant as a hex, or typically as a hex, but sometimes as a binary number. And for simplicity, you'll see the small talker who knows about this do the same thing so they don't have to mentally compute it.
The other place I've seen it where people use binary is in the declarations of cursors, where the binary corresponds to the black and white bits of the image. And by writing each binary number one on top of the other, like each one on a separate line, you can actually see a picture in the ones and zeros corresponding to that cursor.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that too, now that I think about it.
So that's an interesting use of binary. So those are things that people aren't often aware of. To be honest, I don't think I've ever really used anything beyond binary or hex decimal.
Yeah, and the only place I've ever really used them, I think, well, I've seen them for things like cursors, and I've used them when I've have to deal with C and Smalltalk together.
Yeah, and that makes sense in those cases. But it's something that's there that people don't realize. The next one on my list is one that I think a lot of people do know, but string symbol literals with embedded quotes or spaces or numbers or punctuation marks.
Yeah.
You're allowed to say hash and then a quote, and then you can put inside the quotes any string that you, or anything you could put into a string. So if you want to have an embedded quote within the symbol literal, you can put in hash, single quote, some text, quote, quote, and then some more text, and then an end quote. And that will give you a symbol with an embedded quote in it. Again, not something that you use terribly often, but something that's there that people may not realize.
To be honest, most of the time I've used this, it was completely by accident. I've created a symbol and said, why is there a space there?
That's right. Oh, and getting back to radix conversions, in addition to to literals that you can write in different bases, you can print integers out in different bases using a method called printStringRadix:.
Yeah, which is handy if you want to, for some reason, create a binary or hex number and you don't want to do the mental arithmetic necessary.
Yeah. In fact, last weekend, a friend of mine, who, or the 16-year-old son, came over. He was taking a programming course, and he had an assignment to do in Visual Basic where he had to convert between binary, hex, and decimal. And he's there trying to work out how to do this in Visual Basic. And I said, well, here's what you do in Smalltalk. You would say, this number, print string radix, colon 2. And it comes out in binary.
And people will typically tell you that's cheating.
Yeah, that's right. But it was surprisingly easy to show him that. What other things do we have?
Well, you've got byte array literals.
Byte array literals are ones people may have seen. They have the syntax is a hash mark followed by an open square bracket, and then you can put in as many numbers as you wish between 0 and 255, followed by a closed square bracket, and it will create a byte array with those numbers in it.
Now, if you're dealing with HTTP, actually, you'll stumble across these if you look deeply enough into the way the responses come back from a server, because the raw response will come back as a byte array before the system tries to apply whatever encoding is appropriate. And the reason it does that is because the system may, for whatever reason, mainly because the server tells you, oh, this is UTF-8 and it's actually UTF-16, so of course VisualWorks will dutifully believe the header.
Yes.
But, you know, you'll often see this in web stuff because you'll, in addition to getting the unencoded stuff based on whatever guesses or answers the server gave you, you'll have the raw bytes just in case you got back the wrong thing.
And it's very handy to have. A similar class, by the way, is one called uninterpreted bytes.
Yeah.
And this one's used more for binary encoding. The nice thing about uninterpreted bytes is that it's still like a byte array. It can store bytes in it. But there are methods on uninterpreted bytes that allow you to say, give me the value starting at index 5 for the next 4 bytes and interpret it as a long integer in big endian style.
Yeah, and actually you can use that if you push data out to a stream. You could basically, if you decided for some reason you didn't like the way BOSS worked and you really wanted to build your own binary streaming service, that's where you'd go to start.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, recently I've had to write a reader for various binary formats, and it was so easy just taking the bytes, putting them into an uninterpreted byte object, and then saying, okay, this one's big endian, 4 bytes, go fetch it. And it'll give me back the corresponding integer. Well, very handy. If you ever have to read binary files, having uninterpreted bytes makes it easy to interpret. It also has support for doubles and for floats. So you can read those from a binary stream as well.
Yeah. Now, the funny thing is, the next thing you have on this list, I've been in Smalltalk for a long time now. I started in December of 92. So I've been using Smalltalk for eons. And I only really started using Expand Macros, I think it must have been 2 years ago, when Georg Kieg got on my back about making sure that Bottom Feeder was internationalization capable. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make sure that I had message catalogs for everything. Now, I went through and did that, and he went through and helped me make sure I wrapped up all the little pieces I had forgotten. But until I did that, I didn't even really know that Expand Macros existed. And the reason it was useful to me was the case where I'd want to have a parameterized constant coming in from the message catalog. And I was busy creating my own version of this when I stumbled across the fact that it actually was there.
This is a very useful method. It's what it does, first of all, is that it takes a string that has embedded special characters, and I'll explain that in a sec, and will substitute in values or parameters into the string. It's similar to what C has as a printf.
Printf, yeah.
So the method is expand macros. There's also expand macros with, it takes one argument, and expand macros with, it takes two arguments, and so forth. There's also one that takes an arbitrary number of arguments. If you want to see all of the things that you can do with expand macros, there's a class called string parameter substitution. And if you look at the comment of that class, it has a very good description of all the things you can do with it. So the nicest thing, you can put in, into a string, you can put an angle bracket, and then let's say 1P, P means print string, and then a close angle bracket. The 1 means the first parameter that you give to the expand macros. So it'll take whatever the first parameter is, get its print string, and replace that angle bracket 1P angle bracket with that print string. You can put in a string directly rather than just a print string. There's a conditional form where you can say, if this value, if this Boolean value is true, then put this in, otherwise put that in. So you could have something that says person or people, and then the parameter would be a Boolean true or false as to whether it's single or plural. And the substitution would change that true or false into person for single and people for false.
This is a highly useful thing to have because in almost any application you write, you're going to need the moral equivalent of C's printf. And for quite literally years, I had no idea this was even there. And like I said, I've been using Smalltalk for, you know, I guess it's going on 15 years now, when it was only a couple of years ago that I stumbled on this.
Yeah, and quite often people would do this by string concatenation.
That's what I always did. It was, yeah. You know, I invented a half-brained version of this because I didn't know it was there.
Yeah, people would just say, I'll take the first part of my string, you know, there are, and then stop the string there, and then print the number of people, and then if it's single, then print the word people, and otherwise concatenate in the word, sorry, if it's single, put in person, otherwise people, and they just build up the string with Smalltalk code.
Well, the tragedy is you can tell that there are even people in the engineering team, both past and present, who have not completely internalized the existence of this, because there's plenty of that kind of code in the system.
Yeah. Incidentally, this, I believe it's this feature, was not originally available in Visual Age Smalltalk, but became available when the refactoring browser was ported over to it, because they needed access to those methods. Those methods now exist in Visual Age Smalltalk as well as VisualWorks.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of similar to what happened with VisualWorks. There were a whole bunch of collection convenience methods that wandered into VisualWorks when the RB came in, because there were a whole bunch of things like any satisfy and so on. All those things came into VW because the RB made heavy use of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those ones are actually very useful methods as well.
Oh,
and
yeah, yeah.
We may as well mention them. Any satisfy iterates through a collection, running a block, and returns true if any of the elements of the collection return true for the block. And all satisfy verifies that they all return true. Very useful method to have as well.
Yeah, and it's again, there's a lot of cross-pollinization that happens in Smalltalk through that kind of thing coming in and out of the language. Or I should say out of the libraries, really.
Yeah. We're seeing quite a lot of it coming in from Squeak, quite a lot of it between Visual Age and VisualWorks.
Yeah, the thing that I probably want to say not too terribly loudly so my management doesn't hear it is that the interchange with Squeak probably runs in both directions.
Probably.
So.
The next thing I have on my list here is a print converter, which is a useful little class if you want to do conversions of numbers to strings or dates to strings, or I believe vice versa as well.
These are actually used in the system for things like input fields, aren't they?
That's right. That's the class that's used. And the nice thing is that they allow you to specify formats along with the conversions. So you can give it a format string and say, please print out this date as a four-digit year dash, then the name of the month written out in full, dash, and then two digits for the day, and then put mm-hmm. the time into this format. And you specify with that format string how you want it laid out, and it will
lay it out for
you.
Yeah, I think most people run across these incidentally by using the GUI builder or by using class time or timestamp or date.
Right. So those use the print converter to do those conversions for you. But oftentimes you need to do that when you're, let's say, writing out flat files and you don't have access to the visual components. You can directly go to the print converter and it'll work.
I think class print converter might be worthy of me spending a Smalltalk daily screencast on a couple of examples, because it's one of those things, like I said, people stumble across incidentally, but they don't necessarily realize that it's a generic capability. They only realize that it's there for things like date and time and timestamp.
Yeah. And In fact, I'm looking at the list right now. You can put in strings, numbers, dates, timestamps, times, and fixed points. So it can do formatting on all of those. Yeah, that would be worth a screencast.
Yeah, I should probably do a few examples with that. I mean, I'm bringing it up on my other machine right now because I don't want to have Skype go bananas while it tries to cross the CPU.
The next one that I have on my list, well, let me give you a little bit of history on it. The issue is user-defined pragmas.
Well, before you go too deep, you realize that there are, within the ranks of senior small talkers, I guess that's maybe the one way to put this, there's kind of an interesting divide as to whether pragmas even should exist.
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean, or how they should be used. Yeah, there's some people who really seem to dislike having them there for various things. I think, actually, if I'm not mistaken, the RB guys, Don Roberts and John Brandt in particular, I don't think is a big fan of these. But well, partly that's because when they first came in, there was no easy way to search for pragmas in the image.
Yeah, and I can imagine it would make the job of the refactoring browser harder.
Yes.
Back in the old days of Smalltalk, you would sometimes see methods that have angle brackets and then the word primitive colon followed by a number between the angle brackets.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that was a method that was at so low a level, I suppose, that it was implemented by the virtual machine.
Right, and DLLCC adopted similar syntax for making C calls.
That's right. So to make C calls, DLLCC took the same sort of format. And after that point, they started to think, well, if DLLCC is doing it, then maybe it would be good to generalize this so we can use it in more places and have it a general facility. So now you can actually define your own pragmas to use within your own classes.
Yeah, a classic example is back in the day when you'd want to have third-party tool 1 would want to add something to the tools menu off the launcher. And then third-party tool 2 would want to also add something to the tools menu off the launcher. And if you attempted, they'd both modify the actual menu definition, because back in the day that was the only way to do this. And then as a poor schmo who bought both third-party tools, whichever one you loaded last won.
That's right. And menus, especially menus on the launcher, are a wonderful example of the use of pragmas. If you didn't have those, it would make it much more difficult to have third-party tools that didn't interact with other third-party tools.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you load, say, if you're in a development image and you load typeless and bottom feeder, they both want to add themselves to the tools menu, and they don't conflict because they both use pragmas.
Now, back in the day, Envy used to have a mechanism for the Envy menu specifically for people to be able to add in new menu items, but it was an explicit mechanism that you had to call. This one is more like a declaration. It just says, I'm going to declare an extension to the visual launcher. Here is the pragma that says, put it into the menu bar in this place, and here's the code to run. And the system takes care of all the connecting of the menus for you. Incidentally, there's a little bit of work that you have to do if you want to have your own menus that use these pragmas to allow other people to attach to your menus. The visual launcher is set up that way, but there are just a few things that you have to do to get other people to attach to your own menus.
Oh, now there's something I didn't know.
Yeah, this would probably be worth a screencast as well, because it's beyond what I can explain in a podcast. But there are a couple methods that you have to write in order to allow other people to use menus on your application or to extend menus on your application.
Okay, so for instance, not the bottom feeder has this thriving community that I'd like to have it have, but assuming for the sake of argument that it had a thriving community of third-party developers, if I wanted to allow them to extend the menus, these are things I'd have to do.
That's correct. So if any of the plugins wanted to add their own menu items in, then you'd have to implement these couple of methods to set up your menus to allow people to extend them.
You know, it's funny. I invented my own way of doing that for the plugins.
Yeah, which is what Envy did. They invented their own way of doing it.
So it's yet another half-brained implementation of something the system handles, because, again, even though I've been using the system since time began at this point, it's another thing I didn't even know existed.
Yeah. Tell you what, I'll dig up the details and we'll see if we can put together a screencast on how to do that.
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, the funny thing is, this is yet another example that no matter how long you've been using Smalltalk, and it doesn't matter which Smalltalk, CINCOM Smalltalk, Visual Age, Dolphin, I don't care which one you pick, there's probably lots of cool things you just don't know.
That's the amazing thing. I've seen developers who've been using Smalltalk for years and years and years, and then I show them something and they say, wow, I never knew that was there. Just sometimes it's just little things, and sometimes it's little utilities that they never realized existed. There's just so much in the system, it's hard to know everything that's there.
Well, you know, if you go back far enough, now the RB has functions in it to define input accessors and mutators,
yeah.
You know, for instance variables you define.
Yes.
But the funny thing is, there always was a tool in the system for doing that.
Code
and
assist.
I actually hooked it years and years ago because I got tired of having to define the instance variables. And it's been there for years, and most people just never knew it existed. I've now forgotten what the name of the stupid tool was, but it was
a coding assistant.
That's right. And it's been there for years and years.
Yeah, I remember the coding assistant. That was well before the refactoring browser came onto the scene.
Yeah, and I had hooked it years ago for a number of purposes. The nice thing about it was that I had extended the coding assistant so that it would not only generate accessors and mutators, but it would generate the change messages so that if I was writing a GUI, I didn't have to go in and hand modify all of them.
Ah, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, well, it made my life simpler, which was all I was after. I think I was talking to Travis a few days ago, and he defined me as a solution-oriented programmer, which was a nice way of saying that I'm a hacker who likes to solve problems.
Maybe that's a good thing, though.
Until you have to look at my code, yeah, but, you know. So I like the next one you've got on the list here, the compiler class stuff. This is stuff that actually has solved multiple problems over the years. If you look at distributed Smalltalk, the IDL stuff is all done with this. If you look at DLLCC, the C stuff is this.
Yes.
And it's really the only way that Object Studio came into the system was by defining its own compiler, because Object Studio has a few interesting differences from VisualWorks.
Right. So compiler class is a class method that tells you which class to use for the compiler for methods, instance methods of this class, which is a phenomenal concept. One of the amazing examples is in the Advanced Programmers Kit, which is now, of course, just part of Advanced Tools, the parser generator. You can create a parser or use a parser language that's completely different from Smalltalk, but it's stored as Smalltalk code. Like it looks... It takes the form of methods, and they're stored in the store repository. But if you look at the methods, it doesn't look anything like Smalltalk code. That's actually a pattern matching language specifically used to create new languages. That's possible because those classes define compiler class to be this extended parser.
Yeah, and you know the thing is there are examples to ship with the parser compiler of a SQL generator. Not that it does anything terribly useful, but it's an interesting example of that kind of usage.
Mm-hmm. I've used the parser generator to create a fairly nice date parser, which goes beyond what the print converter can do. I could have dates that said, for instance, I could put in next Friday, and it would calculate when next Friday was, and give you the corresponding date for it. It was pretty cool.
That's kind of neat. But yeah, the thing is, recently this, again, came into usage because by bringing Object Studio in to live inside VisualWorks, they implemented an Object Studio compiler, and that way they were able to plug in a lot of things that are specific to Object Studio that wouldn't normally work in VisualWorks. So you have a Smalltalk that has interesting semantic differences, but still works in the same environment because of this kind of thing.
Yes, and in theory, if you wanted to implement, let's say, Ruby within Smalltalk, you could define a Ruby compiler class, and then in the classes that you want to have Ruby code in, define a compiler class method for it on the class side, and then on your instance side, you could put in Ruby methods.
Right, although I know Michael has said this, people have said that the Ruby language is kind of hairy to parse.
Yes. And that's true as well. Ruby is going to be a hard one to parse. But in theory, this is what you could do to get Ruby code into Smalltalk.
Yeah, in theory, if you actually wanted to lose some part of your conscious mind writing that parser.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, shall we go on to the next two?
Yeah, why don't we do the last two or three here?
Okay, I'll go through these quickly. Smalltalk compiler is a class, and there's a class method on it called evaluate colon, which takes a string, compiles it as Smalltalk code, and does a do it on it. So it's just like doing a do it in a workspace. Very handy to have, often used in very dangerous ways if you misuse it. But it can take any string that you wish and basically treat it as small talk code and run it. It has the ability actually to create new methods if you wish and add those methods into the system. The next one then is in the same class, the Smalltalk compiler. There's a method called parse colon class colon, which takes a string containing Smalltalk code, parses it, and gives you back a parse tree of the code. That parse tree is actually a tree of various nodes for the methods and for the variables and for each statement and for blocks and so forth. And then you can create your own visitor that runs through that parse tree looking for certain patterns.
Yeah, no, I've never used that because, to be honest, parse trees are not something I've ever gotten down to that level. As long as I've been in Smalltalk, I never actually got myself a CS degree. I'm not much of a compiler guy. But I've used Evaluate for example purposes. I think I did a screencast, this must be 6-7 months ago now, when somebody was talking about application-generated code, and I demonstrated how you could do that on the fly in Smalltalk via the Evaluate message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very useful for that. It's useful if you have to send code across the wire to another system and have it run on the other end. One place where I've used the parse tree technique is in, this is more of a meta programming kind of thing, but on one project I was on, we needed to know the places where a certain method was called in a certain way. So, for instance, you know, what methods in the system set or call name colon and give it a nil parameter or nil value, like the literal nil. And by using this kind of technique, I could actually search through all the methods, find the ones that send name colon, and I could check the parameter value and see if it was nil. It gave us a good list of all the methods that were called in a certain way.
Yeah.
This kind of technique, by the way, is used by the refactoring browser to do its refactorings, but they don't use the Smalltalk compiler. They use their own. They use one called SMAC.
Yeah. Now, that's actually one of the interesting issues within VisualWorks at the moment, is how many different implementations of that kind of functionality live in the system right now.
Yeah.
Because there's the RB's version, there's the parser compiler in the advanced tools, and I think there's a third one that's escaping me at the moment. Pretty sure there's three of them in there somewhere.
Yeah, various implementations of compiler and then various implementations of browsers.
Yeah, you've got the trippy stuff, which is separate from the RB, and you can't do refactoring from the ones in trippy, and
the browser in the debugger is different than the regular browser.
Yeah, and then there's the stuff that's in store, which is the ancient 5i browsers, and we will try to say as little about those as possible.
I think at this point that's probably enough for this podcast. We have some more stuff we could probably include into a future podcast.
Oh yeah, I think we've filled time admirably today with this stuff. There's plenty more where that came from too.
Yeah, it's interesting that you can talk to various Smalltalkers who've never seen some of these techniques or some of these classes before, and these people have been using Smalltalk for years.
I did a blog post on, and I've done presentations on this, on the way I've scaled my Smalltalk blog server multiple times now, and one of the examples I had was there's a class called Promise.
That's right.
And I was attempting to come up with a way to not blockade the server when certain kinds of requests came in. And I was in the midst of trying to implement that functionality when I think it was Alan said to me, look, class Promise, you dummy. And there it was. And it implemented everything I needed. It's, again, I've been using Smalltalk for eons, and I had no idea it existed.
In fact, after listening to your talk at users conference, I thought, hey, I should add Promise onto my list. And then I forgot to mention it to you.
Yeah, so we can go into more detail on that in a future podcast.
Very good.
All right.
Okay, well, very good, James. So let's cut it off here, and we'll try and do another podcast for next week. I think we have some interesting ones coming up.
Yeah, we have a couple of interviews coming up, and I might have a third interview lined up for the near-term future, so we'll see how that goes.
Excellent.
All right.
Very good. Talk to you later.
Yep, bye.
Bye.
Don't go away. It's time for James Savage with this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. France. GTI Consultants is looking for someone that has experience with Smalltalk and OOAD. Chevy Chase, Maryland. GEICO is looking for a lead programmer that has experience with project management, team leadership, OOAD, client server, SDLC, and has good communication skills. Smalltalk is considered a plus. This permanent position pays $85,000 to $90,000 a year. Cleveland, Ohio, Precision Systems Design is looking for a Smalltalk programmer that also has experience with Java and SQL Server. Colorado Springs or Minneapolis, Minnesota, ATR International, Inc. has relisted a position for a Smalltalk developer. Various employment options are available for the position, which can be worked from either city. Fremont, California, LAM Research still has multiple software engineering positions available. They are looking for someone with experience with Smalltalk, Java, C++, C, .NET, assembly language, and real-time operating systems. You must be willing to travel. Juno Beach, Florida. Florida Power and Light Company is looking for a technology consultant that has experience with Gemstone, Envy, and has good communication skills. Experience with VisualWorks, VisualAge, and AIX are considered pluses. Sacramento, California. Kenda Systems, Inc. is looking for a Smalltalk programmer that also has experience with Object Studio, DCL, VisualWorks, and Pro-C. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And that wraps up this week's Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson of Syncom Systems and David Buck of Cimbron. The next couple of weeks, we should have two interviews, possibly a third coming up. We have David Griswold, the Strongcock guy, and Avi Bryant of DabbleDB. That's a redo since we had a problem with the last one. That was the one that got eaten by PowerGraml. In any case, hope you enjoy those. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. In any event, for questions, comments, concerns, critiques, send an email to smalltalkpodcasts, SMALLTALK, podcasts, PODCASTS, at syncom, CINCOM.com. If you send us an MP3, we'll play it on the air. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be experienced.